Hello, my name is Sam Chandra and this is Deep Sky. Each week we go into conversation helping you to explore and understand the uncharted waters of the intersection of artificial intelligence, aviation, and the future of humanity. As for me, I'm an airline captain, a student of artificial intelligence, and your guide to navigating the world of aviation transformed by artificial intelligence. My guest on this episode is Bryant Walker-Smith. He started out as a transportation engineer, then transitioned into a legal career. Currently, he's an associate professor in the School of Law, and by courtesy, the School of Engineering at the University of South Carolina. He's also an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School and co-director of the University of Michigan Project on Law and Mobility. He previously led the Emerging Technology Law Committee of the Transportation Research Board of the National Academies and served on the U.S. Department of Transportation's Advisory Committee on Automation in Transportation. Bryant advises cities, states, countries, and the UN on emerging transport technologies and is writing on what it means to be a trustworthy company. In our conversation today, we cover the ethical considerations inherent in the introduction of automated vehicles into society. We discuss what this means for companies and leaders of those companies in terms of the centralization of power, trust, law, and how these interface with safety-critical systems. This really is a look at what we as an aviation industry need to be thinking about now and doing next. This is Deep Sky. What do you think the preeminent ethical issue is that we will face with the introduction of autonomous vehicles? If preeminent is the right word.
I think transportation is so obvious to all of us. Everyone thinks they're an expert on traffic. We see cars every day. Some of us are lucky to see planes every day. And so it's a very visible symbol of automation. And so I think that we have a tendency to put all of our hopes and dreams and fears in the basket of the very visible and the very obvious. So much of the social excitement and angst and opportunity over automation generally is going to play out in this one realm of transportation automation, even if it's ultimately, you know, some back-end algorithm that we don't even think about that, you know, vastly improves the power of financial computing in a way that you know, creates wealth or destroys jobs. People aren't going to be angry at that algorithm. They're going to be angry at the car going down the road with a LiDAR twisting on the top, or they're going to be angry at the drone that's buzzing around because that's such an obvious symbol of arguable privacy invasion, even if the more effective versions are hidden, are obscured, are not tangible. So I say that because you asked what's the preeminent ethical issue? Well, I think it's our sense of how we relate to these new systems. Not only the relative control that humans and machines have, but I think much, much, much more significantly, the relative power that humans and the companies behind these automation devices have. Companies act through their agents. Historically, those have been their human agents, right? Their employees. In the future, it's going to be their machine agents, their algorithms as well. And so it's really understanding the tremendous power that these companies have and will have, and the extent to which a lot of our historically public spaces will continue to be private or quasi-public, quasi-private spaces.
Okay, and you're saying, so because now the power will probably be more concentrated because organizations will be operating these vehicles at large, you have to be more careful with that concentration of power?
Absolutely. And this is this kind of centralization or systemization is the story of human progress, right? We take one set of problems, we replace them with a new set of problems, and we just really, really hope that our new set in aggregate is smaller than our old set. It reminds me of over 100 years ago when the internal combustion engine was introduced. into cities, and people said, hallelujah, this is the environmentally friendly the transportation solution. This will solve our pollution problems. And they were, I see you laughing, Sam, you probably know what they were thinking of.
Yeah, horse poo.
Absolutely. Average horse, 10 kilos of manure a day, 100,000 horses in New York in 1900. Your listeners can do the math. I'll pause. That was a lot of manure, right? And so people said, well, we've solved pollution. And then, you know, fast forward 20 years and it turns out we hadn't. And we see that playing out in centralization. So, you know, 200 years ago, a bunch of family farms, you'd have some contamination and a few people would get sick. You have centralization, and at least in theory, we have better processes, better quality control. It's at least in theory, easier to centralize that sort of monitoring. But at the point that something slips through, it's not a few people, it's many people. And so we have these same issues with automation. Same with shopping malls 30 years ago. People said, well, wait a second. We used to have these open public downtowns, and now we have these areas controlled by private companies. We have lots of historical examples. In law, we say that when nothing is relevant, everything is relevant. And I think we're at the point where we're dealing with both. Nothing is truly relevant to automation. And so all of these things in the past are useful up to a point.
That's a very interesting point there. How we've seen the centralization of not just transportation, but public space and a bunch of other things in society, and therefore more scrutiny falls on the corporation in most cases. For the aviation context, we see there's probably significantly more centralization when it comes to regulatory activities, when it comes to operational activities, and even controlling an aircraft. You know, one pilot can control an aircraft for 100 people. One company can control hundreds of aircraft, where that's not so common, especially for private motor vehicles. Do you think that means that saying that aviation airlines could potentially just be further down that path already, and they've maybe crossed some of those hurdles, and therefore there are less hurdles ahead in that respect?
Yeah. So we're kind of dealing with analogies at this point. And I kind of think any analogy is kind of like autopilot, right? It works really well unless and until it doesn't. And then it falls apart in dramatic fashion.
Right.
And so with aviation, I think you're in one way, at least, aviation's become maybe a little more decentralized with an increasing reliance on suppliers and weird supply networks. I agree in many other respects, automation is an example of a very holistic system. I think that over at the U.S. Department of Transportation, at least, an agency like the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, probably looks over somewhat enviously at the Federal Aviation Administration, because the FAA controls, or at least you know, says it controls every aspect of aviation, right? From the approval of aircraft to the regulation of pilots and airlines. The FAA has at least asserted previously that the airspace in its entirety is under its control, right? So, you know, you toss a ball up into the air, that's suddenly national airspace. Cities and others have disputed that, but you have one agency that gets to supervise everything and has a relatively small number of players. Even in the most diffuse, in general aviation, still the pilot community is relatively small, and the FAA treats it as a community. You know, contrast that with driving, where hundreds of millions of people have licenses, are poorly trained, are regulated by states, when the vehicles they buy may have been initially regulated by the federal government, on roads that are under the authority of many different agencies. It's a real big mess. So I think aviation offers some examples of what works really well when you have this kind of central control, as well as some potential pitfalls for where one size fits all, or one approach might not always work.
And do you think that the key to being able to successfully centralize that is trust? I saw on Twitter that Waymo was making some inroads in that. I just saw that like 5 minutes ago on your Twitter feed. So could you maybe talk about how they've had to build trust in order to get more acceptance of what they're doing in the community?
I think trust we misfocus on trust. Like so often you'll see surveys of do people trust automated vehicles? Right? And everyone wants to do one of those surveys and every reporter wants to write about it. And I'm always like, oh, come on.
So true.
What does that mean? First of all, we shouldn't trust automated vehicles because with the singular exception of a small deployment in Arizona, they on the roads, they don't exist. We have driver assistance systems. And so someone who is trusting something that is non-existent has I think, serious over-trust problems. But secondly, this is an area where we just haven't come face to face with automated vehicles yet. And two of the most powerful industries in our country, right, the automotive industry and the information technology industry, haven't even gotten around yet to trying to convince us that we should trust automated vehicles. At the point that they start focusing their marketing dollars on convincing us that AVs are great, well, I think a lot of us are going to be rather amenable to their perspective. We have, if you go back, what is it now, 15 years, and you would ask people, do you want a smartphone? They'd be like, what's that? Why would I need that? That's ridiculous. That's creepy. And then they started realizing that they could, bill another hour of time or talk with their grandkids or see a lot of cat videos. To your earlier point, Sam, yes, it's not just identifying them from the internet. Everybody loves cats. So, and at that point, people got smartphones. So I'm actually concerned that we're going to end up over-trusting rather than there's some right. weird deficit of trust right now. For me, the question isn't, do we trust new technologies? It's, are the companies developing and deploying these new technologies worthy of our trust? In fact, worthy of the trust that we might necessarily place in them, even if we're not particularly thrilled about that prospect. And so I focus less on trust and much more on trustworthiness. That is, what makes a company trustworthy?
Because that's the key thing here. If they're the ones that are really have our lives in their hands, it's the organizations we're going to have to trust. I feel as though there is not much thought put towards the trust of a car manufacturer, perhaps, but there's a significant thought put towards the trust of an airline or an airplane manufacturer because people are just generally more scared of doing something like that. Do you think that there's a big delta that needs to be closed before we can see these autonomous vehicles being rolled out? Or do you think the trust in the manufacturers actually already is there? It's just the vehicles that people don't trust.
Yeah. So I think we could talk to multiple domains here. What I would say is so often the question is, well, what needs to happen for us to get shiny, cool new things? And I also... See, clearly, I just don't like questions. And I always say, well, no, that's the wrong question, right? Because we're going to get our shiny new things. That's not at issue. There are ways that could happen quicker or easier. But eventually, companies find a way to make things happen. It's the corn syrup issue, right? If you have a whole bunch of a glut of corn, then you're going to make corn syrup. It's going to find its way. And so the question isn't what will make this happen, but what will make this happen successfully, right? In what way will the technologies be deployed in a way that achieves policy goals? There's a difference between AVs being on the roads and AVs being on the roads in a way that helps us. And so there, I think a focus on trustworthiness is really important for all sectors. And I can't really compare the relative either empirical trust or earned trustworthiness of say an automaker or an airline. I think in the automotive industry, there have been profound examples of betrayals of trust. And the 737 MAX debacle has certainly been revealing in all sorts of ways on that as well. And this is the key about trustworthiness of companies. There are lots of things that go into it, right? A trustworthy company says what they're doing, why they think it's reasonably safe, and why the rest of us should believe us. They're open and candid about their limitations and their failures. And when they do fail, they make it right. And once a plane crashes, once a robot goes berserk, right? Once an automated vehicle runs into a fire truck, we're going to lose trust in that technology because it has manifestly failed. The company still has an opportunity not to be perfect, but to be trustworthy, because right. their obligations don't end with the crash. They can explain what happened. They can explain why it's not going to happen again. And they can do right by the people who were injured and by everybody else. And that's the important part about trustworthiness. It needs to be built and earned at a level that transcends the individual hiccups and failures and even tragedies.
That's a fascinating take on trustworthiness. There was a little NBC op-ed that you did. And in there, you said that we need to go from crashes being normal and inevitable to anomalous and investigated. The aviation industry is the latter. Could you explain that statement further?
Yeah, and really, I think the aviation industry emphasizes this for us. So in just the United States today, 100 people are going to die on the roads. Now, far more are going to die from COVID today. But in an ordinary year, that would certainly place driving as one of the most dangerous activities. And yet it's not reported like that. So if there were to be a commercial airline crash today, that would make the front pages everywhere. But even though far more people worldwide will die in crashes on the road, those aren't going to make headlines. Those might at most make, you know, the back end of a paper or the obituaries a few days later. So people who are terribly, terribly imperfect about perceiving risk, don't understand the crisis that we have in ground transportation. And as a result, we are not addressing it with the urgency that we should. Aviation is a very different example where even a more junior industry has received the resources, the attention, the policy efforts and the investigatory effort so that any single crash is treated as something that should never happen again. And the causes are understood. The systems are put in place to respond. And we learn something. Now, this comes back to our earlier discussion of centralization. In the future, when we don't have hundreds of millions of drivers, but we have a few drivers, that is a few companies with their systems, it will be much easier to identify, investigate, and fix specific problems. And it will be in many cases a software update. And that offers the opportunity at least to start moving ground transportation into that same frame as aviation.
So you are a lawyer. You have a Juris Doctor from the New York University School of Law. How's New York, by the way? Was it a cool place to be?
Oh, New York's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd always like to go. Everyone says it's really, really cool place. So maybe not right now, but maybe in a couple of years. Be nice.
We could recommend our favorite tourist spots. I'm more than happy. New York's a great place to be a student for anyone.
Oh, really? But why specifically student?
You don't have to compete with 9 million other people for the grocery store or the park. You can kind of set your own schedule. whether that's 2 p.m. or 2 a.m.
Mm. That's a good point. Yeah, nice. Do they have big campuses? Like I studied at Western Michigan University for one semester. For me, it's like, wow, there's a whole campus. You've got a football field, everything. As an Australian, it was such a different experience, hey, compared to my city campus university in Melbourne. Was it a city campus in New York, or did they have the full football field, blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, NYU was really one with the city.
Okay.
Sometimes not necessarily, to the amusement of the other city folk. A campus like Columbia is in some parts by design, more self-contained. There is a long history of fraught relations, particularly in the case of Columbia with a racial dimension.
All right, I'll start that one again.
I mean, you're not going to include that part?
I could, I guess so. Why not? I mean, depends if people are interested. I'm interested. Yeah. So you hold a Juris Doctor from the New York. You hold a Juris Doctor from the New York University School of Law. Could you perhaps outline if you foresee any changes to the liability of the manufacturer now that they essentially become the driver or the pilot?
Yeah. So as more becomes under the control of companies, manufacturers, and others, and more becomes possible, I expect that the practical effect will be a greater share of crashes or other incidents will involve some liability for the companies that are developing or deploying these systems. Now, the hope is that the total number or in magnitude of these incidents will decrease. That's a hope. And so what, from a manufacturer's perspective, you're ideally looking at a bigger slice of a smaller pie of total liability, because there's a smaller pie of total crash costs. Yeah. What that means in practical terms is a lot of law, particularly liability law. And liability law is when you're hurt, who do you sue? And can you recover from them for your injuries? There are a lot of theories that have general application. So products liability law and tort law generally are flexible. We talk about reasonableness often. Reasonableness of the people, whether a company is acting reasonably. Reasonableness of the products, whether a system is performing reasonably. And that's very flexible. And so any particular situation will always be dependent on the specific facts and the specific law. If we were to say, imagine that you and I are driving down the road, Sam, and our cars collide and someone asks, well, who's liable? And the obvious answer is it's you, Sam, because this is my hypo. Beyond that, what we'd say, well, it depends, right? Who had the stop sign? How fast were we going? What were the conditions? What were the causes? And that will be true with automation as well, where there will be a multitude of potential explanations involving many different actors. And we'll ask, well, was the system properly designed? Were the data correct? Was the hardware correctly assembled? Was the system properly maintained and updated? Was it deployed in appropriate conditions? And so on and so on. And it could be that multiple actors played some role, that is some culpable role in the incident. And they will sort it out amongst themselves, under the laws of the particular state or other jurisdiction. We don't have one set of liability law. In the US alone, we have well over 50 different rules of liability because we have over 50 states and other jurisdictions.
One problem I foresee in that is say autonomous vehicle against autonomous vehicle, none of them were breaking any laws, they crash, whatever it is. a lot of these cars and these airplanes are being embedded with deep neural networks. And do you foresee these deep neural networks spitting out these conclusions, doing the wrong thing, and then you have to sort of decide what went wrong in that case? Do you foresee that being an obstacle to rolling out to apportioning blame?
So a lot of questions you have in there. First, obstacle to actual deployment. Well, the FAA and others are thinking quite seriously about these at least putatively non-deterministic systems. And I'm a little skeptical that's correct in the mathematical sense. They're very complex often in a way that we can't understand, even if there is a route. They're thinking about how you approach the regulation of these systems, where repeatability is not necessarily something that can be achieved in the traditional sense. This is why I again focus on trustworthiness for the companies, because at some level, companies will be making representations to agencies and to the public, whether about the overall safety or about what that safety entails, or even about the data on which then conclusions of safety can be based. And these companies will themselves have to develop their safety cases. Right? That's what companies do. I think they should make those public. But the question will be, do we trust the companies that are making these representations? And that is should be a critical aspect of regulation. So I think that these issues, though, will not preclude deployment. And then regulation will continue to be a ongoing thing, just like safety is an ongoing thing, right? Safety is not a wedding. Safety is a marriage, a lifelong commitment rather than a one-time event that's iterative, that involves thinking about the whole life cycle, and agencies will be engaged in that. And so when there are nonetheless incidents or crashes, that will involve all kinds of investigation and potential litigation, private, public, everything in between. Data will be a very important part of that. And data will resolve some ambiguities, and it will introduce other ambiguities. There was a case several years ago of an automaker successfully arguing that its own data unit on a vehicle should not be trusted. They're like, yes, it says this, but that's wrong. This was an experimental thing, and don't trust that. Don't trust that number. And the court said, yeah, you're right. So when you think about data as always being, you know, clear and unambiguous, and that's just not the case. It raises as many questions as it answers. So managing these data, whether that's in litigation discovery or in investigation, will be a very complex task that will require a lot of resources. But you're asking even a step further than we get to what are arguably, you know, opaque, non-transparent, inauditable systems to some degree. And when you describe these complex systems that do things that we can't quite predict, that we have to accept kind of post hoc rationalizations for, I tend to think of people, individual humans who can't really say why they did something and after the fact have a story that, you know, conveniently makes them seem like the hero. We deal with that. The issue from litigation and liability, I think, will be, well, expensive, somewhat straightforward. And we say, well, look, did ultimately this system behave reasonably or not? Did it do what we would have expected it to do? And then if it did, then liability would be much less likely. And if it didn't, or if it was so complex that it suggested sloppiness, and this was an issue in some of the recent unintended acceleration litigation, then I think we'll see some liability.
What's sloppiness in this context?
Oh, sloppiness is code or other design that suggests that you had 1,000 cooks in the kitchen. None of them was following a standard. And the result was sloppy code that could not be fully explained or understood, and that suggested the high likelihood of a mistake somewhere.
Actual sloppiness with, so the coders themselves were perhaps not in the square as they should be, following all the rules, being sort of managed enough, and then this code was put into a box, and then it was put into a real thing, and then the real thing went on the road, and then the real thing did some real things. Is that what sloppiness was in that case?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So specifically this involved, allegations of sudden unintended acceleration in one manufacturer's motor vehicles. Mm. And there were ultimately many causes for that. Some of them were human, some of them were purely mechanical, that is like format entrapment. Some of them reflected bad design. But one of the most famous cases that produced a massive jury verdict was, I think, best explained by the jury saying, well, this code just is bad. And experts were able to tear apart the code. And even though direct link between the software and the acceleration was demonstrated, nonetheless, the software and hence the company came out looking so bad that it was at least plausible to the jury that something was askew and amiss.
Mm.
It's important to show your work and to explain your work. And that's not just explainability of AI. That's really a company's ability to explain its entire safety process. To share its safety philosophy and say, here's what we're doing. Here's why we think it's reasonably safe. And here's why you can trust us.
Mm.
That communication is so important.
What comes to mind is a safety management system approach to ensuring these deep neural networks work. You monitor their output, you have continuous feedback, and you continuously change and update the system that they're in order to ensure continuous safe operation. And there's a bunch of different elements, governance, reporting, training, all that sort of stuff in the process. It's an area, to be honest, I'm personally fascinated about, and I think there's a huge body of work that needs to be done and that is just waiting there to be done to ensure that these deep neural networks have a high level of assurance when you pop them in these safety critical systems. I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
Have you come across any work in that field in terms of assuring deep neural networks?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot. One of the premises is accepting that every component of a system is prone to failure, right? Humans are going to fail. Automated systems are going to fail. Hardware, as we saw, is going to fail. And then the combination of those, or the lack of coordination between those, magnifies the problems. And so moving toward a system approach that recognizes that degradation needs to be graceful, that is understanding how we can make things less bad. And this is intricately connected even with recent cybersecurity concerns. We just cannot assume that any one of these systems will be infallible, and we have to look at them all in combination. I tend to, and this is, I guess this is how I frame it. We do want really flexible systems that can adapt to whatever, frankly, unpredictable, weird stuff happens out in the world, right? The deer jumping off the bridge, the lasers and drones ending up in front of an aircraft, right? But there might have to be some bounds to that. Maybe we should never have a ground vehicle speed up to 200 miles an hour. Just because if it's doing that, it suggests that something is bad. Now, there might be a time when you actually do need to go that fast, right? You're trying to escape a hurricane or some very fast moving zombies. But that is so much less likely than the prospect of that speed resulting from an attack or from some failure of a system. And so I would put kind of a soft duffel bag, right? This is the flexible system inside of a much larger hard shell suitcase. That's the outer bound. That's the frame. That's the maybe the deterministic system. And that does mean that we might occasionally have to accept, at least initially, some of these really weird instances of non-optimization in order to prevent weird things happening in the more ordinary case. Now, the approach to this is also what in the language of J3016, this is the levels of automation you're alluding to, is the operational design domain, the ODD. That is the area under which a system is designed to operate or is restricted in its operation at higher levels.
The flight envelope.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, the analog to the flight envelope. And I think we'll see that is actually one of the key limiters. Companies won't compete on safety, right? They'll get to a level where they are comfortable in the safety of a system, but that will be dependent on a very limited set of operating conditions. And as they get more comfortable, those operating conditions, that envelope will expand and expand and expand.
Is there anything you'd like to say or talk about, or you think is the thing to be considering?
The thing to be considering. So here's my challenge, actually, if I were to talk to somebody at the height of their career, right? The best pilot, the best executive. Tell us what you've been wrong about. Except that we think you're amazing and that you have achieved what most people can only dream of. Now's the time for some circumspection and some honesty and tell us what you screwed up. Tell us what you wish you had done differently. And I say that to the individuals, but I'd also say that to companies. And I realize this is fraught, but try to say what's really hard in operations, in technology development. Say where you've guessed wrong, where you've overestimated. Say what has surprised you. Say what's been really difficult. Talk to us about what's tough. Talk to us about your failures rather than just your successes. Because that is really important to developing this foundation of trustworthiness so that we believe you when you tell us that you've gotten something right, because you've been willing to say when you've gotten something wrong in the past. That we understand that these technologies are not yet necessarily ready in every way, because you're talking to us not just about the latest record or claim, but also about the thing that didn't quite work. This has been, I think, most pronounced in the ground context with some very overhyped claims by one particular company, a company that has borrowed some aviation language. And I tend to say, if we can't trust you when you say your system is self-driving or fully self-driving, then why can or should we trust you when you say your system is safe? And I would bring that same philosophy to an airline or any other large company. You need to speak truthfully and candidly about everything so that the things that really matter actually count.
That is a fantastic thing to end on. Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Deep Sky. I hope you are able to take away plenty to think about concerning the issues of centralization, liability, algorithmic safety, and the overall trust narrative in implementing higher levels of autonomy into aviation. If you'd like to learn more about what Bryant is doing in artificial intelligence, ethics, and law, please go to his website, newlypossible.org, a link of which will be available in the show notes. If you have any questions about the future of AI in aviation, or would like to have a chat about how AI may impact your business or career in the future, then please send me an email at samuel.chandra01@gmail.com. The email address is in the show notes. Please do come back next week for another engaging conversation. This is Deep Sky.